I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Stanford Professor of Education Linda Darling Hammond. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Linda Darling Hammond. Stanford Education Professor Linda Darling Hammond founded the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy in Education, which conducts research and policy analysis on issues affecting educational equity and opportunity, including curriculum, assessment, and teaching policy and practices. She chairs the California Commission on Teacher Credentialing. From 1994 to 2001, she was executive director of the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future, whose 1996 report led to sweeping policy changes affecting teaching and schooling, and was named one of the most influential reports affecting U.S. education. In 2006, Linda Darling Hammond was named one of the nation's 10 most influential people affecting educational policy over the past decade, and in 2008, she served as the leader of President Barack Obama's education policy transition team. Among Linda Darling Hammond's many publications are The Flat World in Education, Learning to Teach for Social Justice, and The Right to Learn. Linda Darling Hammond is here tonight to describe what she calls the educational renaissance in California and what the issues are that will determine California's future. Please join me in welcoming her to the JCCSF.
Well, I am just delighted to be here, and thank you for that gracious introduction. And I want to talk this evening about something that you may or may not have noticed, which is that while California has had a very challenging last decade, we have made tremendous changes in the last few years and are headed to a very different future, which will not only have implications for us here in the state, but also for the nation as a whole, because others across the country are beginning to pay attention to the independent path that California is beginning to set for itself in education. The title of the talk, From Worst to First, is really a turnaround on John Merrow's film of some years ago that you may recall called From First to Worst, which was describing the slide in California that got us to begin to illustrate what happens when you ignore the advice of John Dewey. You'll remember that many years ago, 100 years or more, Dewey noted that what the best and wisest parent wants for his or her child, that must the community want for all of its children. Any other goal is narrow and unlovely, and acted upon, it destroys our democracy. And we did embark on a course of events following Prop 13 and a number of other policy events that began to rend our state apart in terms of the degree of inequality that it was creating and, in fact, was close to destroying our democracy. But, in fact, we have, in the nick of time, begun to really turn things around. But let's start the story at the very beginning. From what many would definitely have identified as the highest achieving state in the nation in the 1970s with one of the strongest education systems. How many of you were in one way or another products of that system? I see a lot of hands going up, both in K-12 and in higher education. But something happened, and let's remember briefly what that was. There we go.
Directing air traffic in our nation's skies. Building the cars we drive. Processing our tax returns. And handling tasks vital to our health. These and other critical jobs will likely be performed by the students now attending public schools in California. where one of every eight American children is educated. And that ought to scare every one of us.
We've basically turned our back on schools.
Once a leader in public education, California is now near the bottom.
There's something missing in the system.
Those schools are slums. There's no better word for it.
We're always on a survival level.
Coming up, journalist John Merrow examines how the nation's largest school system fell from first to worst and why that matters to the entire country.
So that's our frame. You know, what was going on that caused that to happen? And I want to just stay a little bit longer on memory road. I'm going to show you kind of what the immediate events were that propelled that slide. And I love the fact that we start with Jerry Brown, who had to oversee the beginning of the demise. And I think now, in a very personal way, after his experience as governor, then as a mayor in Oakland, and now as governor again, is determined to turn this around. And as someone who has the opportunity to work with him on that task, I can tell you he is very single-minded about it.
This executive order will freeze all job hirings and job replacements in the state of California.
California felt the effects of Proposition 13 immediately.
The first firings were announced in San Diego, an across-the-board reduction in all county departments. And what will happen in the schools?
Summer school went away for my second child because that was one of the first things to be cut. And the textbooks became older, and the special services for health became less.
It affected a whole lot of other things, arts programs, music programs, phys ed, language programs, counselors, nurses, librarians, libraries.
They cut the classroom periods from 7 periods to 6 periods, and then some school districts cut to 5 periods. So we actually cut the school day in high school dramatically.
People who came here all through the period of the 80s and into the 90s were shocked at how bad things were in a lot of the schools.
What began as a grassroots campaign in California became a national movement. Its founder, Howard Jarvis, died in 1986. His Proposition 13 is still in effect, along with a legacy of unintended consequences.
And so what happened, of course, people didn't notice it at first. They, you know, there was this moniker in the 1980s that money doesn't matter, that we can cut and it won't create different outcomes in schools. California funding not only went down, but it became way more unequal. So we had some schools, predominantly African-American and Latino schools in Compton, Baldwin Park, et cetera. San Francisco, just at about the California state average, which was way below that of other states, way below the basic aid districts. There's Sausalito up there at the top, spending about 3 times more. So we became very unequal. That creates a situation in which salaries vary widely. In San Francisco Bay Area, we had some school districts like Portola Valley Elementary, which was spending at the 98th percentile for the state. And then just a few miles away, you can see Oakland at about the 20th percentile. So a beginning teacher could earn $10,000 more going a few miles away than they would earn in San Francisco or Oakland or other urban areas. And so we began to get a very unevenly distributed educator workforce as well because of the differences in funding. Those low-salary districts serve the higher-need students, so the lowest-salary districts were serving mostly minority students and about twice as many English learners as higher-salary districts. This, of course, produced what we saw substantially during the 1990s. High-minority and high-poverty schools had 8 to 10 times as many unqualified teachers as low-minority or low-poverty schools. And we began to build up a context in which we were essentially saying to some students, your education doesn't count at all, although everybody in the whole state was suffering to some extent. And these kinds of events became commonplace.
It was not uncommon to find schools like this one in Los Angeles where half of the teachers were uncertified. Now, what's your background as a teacher?
Well, I just started teaching. I'm new at teaching. And basically, I'm getting my credentials right now. Yeah, so it's like a learning process for me, too.
Mr. Garcia seems like a nice man. He's new, though. Who was your teacher at the beginning?
The first one, he was a police.
A policeman?
Yeah. Ah. So he worked at the night. So in the morning, he came to sleep.
To sleep during class?
Yeah. Oh. He said, okay, do math at page 31. Then we started, and then when he see that everyone was doing math, he started to sleep.
So it got pretty bad in California and in many communities. Oakland got to the point where in order to save money, they hired substitute teachers rather than trained or experienced teachers because they cost less, didn't need the same benefits. They'd hold on to them for a short time. And the kids described 10 or 12 teachers, you know, who cycle through the classrooms. So by 2010, California was one of the lowest spending states overall, as well as relative to our wealth and our cost of living, one of the most unequally resourced, one of the most segregated states for students, one of the top 3 to 5 most segregated states, 50th in ratios of pupils to teachers, administrators, and counselors, in the bottom decile in student achievement. We had effectively made ourselves a southern state with respect to education, in the sense of replacing, and there used to be a joke about the school state rankings where folks would say, well, thank God for Mississippi. Well, it was California saying thank God for Mississippi because it was the only state ranking lower than California. And the strategy of starving schools and allowing them to become so unequal was penny wise and pound foolish. Our prison population over that period of time quadrupled from the 1980s to about 2010. Corrections costs increased by 900%. School expenditures increased by only about 25%. School expenditures stalled and then declined. The state got to a point where it was paying $50,000 a year to incarcerate young men that it would not spend $10,000 a year to educate a few years earlier. And we continue to have the effects of this, although, as you may know, corrections costs are now coming down, prisons are being reduced in scope and scale, and we are beginning to put more money back in the education system. But we did get to the place where, along with 5 other states, corrections costs outstripped spending on public higher education. So back in 1980, prisons were about 2% of the budget. Public higher education, which has been a gem and a sort of a treasure in our state, were close to 11%. They crossed. Higher ed went down to about 8%. Prisons went up to about 11%. And so that's not the way that you want to build a future in a society where education matters and where the welfare of every person depends on the education capacity and the capacity to engage the economy of every other person. We're not in an era where we can say, I've got mine, sorry for you if you don't get yours, because it affects all of us. So the outcomes of those years when we were not investing, but we were engaged in more and more high-stakes testing, we got to the point where we had 35 different tests that kids took before they encountered the ACT or the SAT or the AP tests or whatever. And all of those tests were almost entirely multiple choice, was that we ended up with a more rote-oriented curriculum, less attention to writing, research projects. Science just about disappeared at elementary schools in California. And when it was taught, there was a cap on inquiry of only 10% that state board had put on. We didn't want too much investigation going on in science. Better to have memorization. And other higher-order learning. We had higher rates of grade retention, which is, of course, costly, increased dropout and pushout rates, loss of good teachers from low-ranked schools because the punitive nature of the accountability system made it very hard, both because you'd be paid less You have larger class sizes. You use your little bit of salary to buy the books, supplies, materials, and equipment. And then you would get denigrated because the kids who were coming from increasingly low-income homes didn't score well on tests. And rather than the system investing more in those schools so that they could meet the needs of the students, the nature of the accountability system mostly just labeled shamed and sometimes closed the schools. We've had two or three generations of schools in some communities like Oakland where a school would do poorly, we'd close it, start another school. Same kids, same needs, same lack of money. That school also got what? Low test scores, and then close it and do this thing all over again, and continued inequality in resources. Now, this is not just a California issue. It's been a national strategy over the last 10 years for accountability, so-called accountability. And the people began, finally, took a long time to fight back. I came here from New York State about 17 years ago. And you may know that New Yorkers have a reputation for being a little in your face. And I was really stunned by how bad the schools had grown in California, but also how little concern there was at that time in the late 1990s, that people were still kind of waking up to the fact that relative to other states, we were really letting kids down. And there was not, I was waiting for marches in the streets. Well, the marches in the streets finally started about 12 years later. So meanwhile, while all this has been going on, the challenges of 21st century teaching have been increasing. Everyone knows there's a greater need for education in society. More jobs demand higher levels of skills. We have higher standards for learning. This is true all around the globe. These kinds of changes are going on with more diverse students, with a wider range of educational needs. We expect more of schools. We didn't used to expect that schools would produce equitable learning outcomes. We just expected that they would deliver the curriculum and whatever happened would happen. Now we're putting all of that expectation on schools as well. The demand for skills is changing. There's an increased demand for complex communications and expert thinking skills, a decreased demand for routine, manual, or cognitive kinds of skills. And one of the dilemmas of schools is that the skills that are the easiest to teach and to test, particularly in the way that American schools have tended to test, are also the ones that are the easiest to digitize, automate, and outsource. So here we have to really transform the way we think about education. Schooling in the industrial age was really educating for discipline, for following orders, for being obedient and compliant and doing as you're told. And on the assembly line, you would do that one job over and over again. Schooling in today's knowledge economy is really about trying to produce motivated and self-reliant citizens who can use knowledge and technologies, design tools, solve problems, acquire new skills, collaborate in fast-changing globalized contexts. And what you see as a result of this change is that education, it used to be that you could have an under or relatively uneducated workforce and it didn't matter for business productivity because mostly it was that sort of industrial era organization of work. But now the share of adults with at least a college degree is closely related to the growth in productivity in states. And you can see that the states that are both highly educated and have very high and growing productivity are Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. You'll see typically the New England states end up at the top. I'm going to return to those three states in a moment because there's a particular story to tell about them. So here we have this change in the way that we're thinking about knowledge and skills. Lots of people define 21st century skills in terms of ways of thinking, more emphasis on problem solving, creativity, innovation, ways of working through collaboration and communication of various kinds, using new digital tools, and also in terms of personal and social responsibility and living in the world. We actually, out of all the things we need our education system to do, producing thoughtful, empathic human beings who are good problem solvers and who can live peacefully and resolve conflict and end the destructive cycles of climate change and war and scarcity in the world is the single most important thing we need for this planet to survive. So the incessant drive to get multiple choice test scores to climb, which usually squeezes out of the curriculum all of the time for more the higher order thinking skills and these other kinds of development, are not going to get us where we ultimately need to go. So that's the agenda, and California was completely missing that boat in almost every imaginable way for much of that last couple of decades.
You're listening to Stanford Professor of Education Linda Darling-Hammond on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Terrific educators who are willing to go against the norm and create innovative schools, and we have many of them here in San Francisco, in Oakland, and other places, are the heroes and heroines of this story, because without a policy system helping them, they nonetheless kept their eye on the ball, devoted themselves in extraordinary ways to kids, and that's the kind of hidden treasure that I think we can build on and that we should be holding up for emulation and support in this next era. The new game in town is college and career readiness. Everybody's talking about it. It's the thing that we're doing. And key to that is understanding that college readiness is not a 22 on the ACT or whatever the analog will be on the new SAT, because students are not entering a multiple choice world. Real college and career readiness is going to be about this kind of ability to find and synthesize and evaluate and use knowledge and so on. Now, as a Stanford person, I don't usually like to quote people from Cal Berkeley. But I have to quote them because there are a couple of professors there who are doing really interesting work, and they are measuring the growth of knowledge in the world, and they put out these reports. And I was so struck when they put out a report about the period from 1999 to 2003. There was more new knowledge created in the world in that short period than in the entire history of the world preceding. Blow your mind. Just think about it for a minute. At that time, technology knowledge was doubling every 2 years. It's now doubling every year. And by the time I finish this sentence, it will probably be doubling every 6 months. That means you can't chop up the curriculum into 12, you know, units and say, I'm going to spoon-feed you these facts in first grade and these facts in second, and by the time you get to 12th, you'll be all baked and done and ready for the world, because the people we're preparing are going to be working with knowledge that hasn't been invented yet, using technologies that we don't know about and can't envision, solving problems that we have failed to solve. So we really need to be preparing people who can learn to learn. And the vice president for hiring at Google recently was quoted by Tom Friedman as saying, we don't use any of the tests when we're deciding who to hire, because they tell us nothing that we need to know about whether someone will be successful. The most important thing we look for is learning ability, the ability to learn on your own, the ability to go after information, figure it out, put it together, weigh in balance, work with others, figure out how to be resourceful, and use your brain in those ways. So when we think about the road ahead, part of the conversation is about, you know, being internationally comparable and benchmarked and all of that. And, you know, we get these results from PISA. Now, there are a lot of issues around PISA. If you correct the results on PISA for poverty levels, we do much better than if you, compare us to countries that don't have the level of childhood poverty that we have. But there are these countries that come out near the top on PISA. And in many cases, there are a number of countries that were very poor, very inequitable, highly inequitable, barely had a system for most kids 40 years ago, that are now very high achieving and equitable in their outcomes. And some of them are very multicultural countries that also have had to deal with how do you close gaps with minority groups and multilingual societies, Singapore being one that reflects that reality. But we also see, you know, countries coming onto the top list of countries like Vietnam is a recent arrival in science that nobody expected to see there, and others. And so, and the U.S. is, you know, 20 in the 20s to 30s in those rankings. But it is interesting to find out, particularly in cases where the countries have gone from being inequitable and low achieving to high achieving, what have they done? And you find some common themes. Supports for children's welfare. Early childhood care and preschool with well-qualified teachers, health supports, etc. So kids in most countries are well-supported. We have the highest child poverty rate in the industrialized world at close to 25%. In most of these countries, after government transfers, childhood poverty is under 5%. They just don't let kids, you know, be under supported. And if you are poor, there are all kinds of ways to be sure that you have housing, that you have health care, that you have food as part of the way the society operates. Equitable resources to schools. Instead of spending four times more on some schools than others, they fund schools equally. And if they add money, it's for the schools that serve the highest need kids. Equitable access to a 21st century curriculum. We actually in this country pride ourselves on being more open, which was true at one time, but we also have lots of ways to track kids beginning in kindergarten. And in most of these countries, kids get the same curriculum at least till 10th grade, and it's focused on higher order thinking and performance skills. The assessments, which are few, are typically open-ended essays and problem solutions and even projects and investigations that teachers score that are part of the assessment system. Almost nobody uses multiple choice tests to any great degree, and nobody tests every child every year. We are the most tested and the least examined group of kids in the world. And they make substantial investments in teacher education. If you were a teacher in Finland or Singapore or Korea or Canada or many other places, you would go to a high-quality preparation program, relatively fewer of them, of a relatively more standard quality, completely free with a stipend while you train. If you were in Singapore, you'd earn $30,000 to $50,000 while you're in teacher ed. Because you're already on the government payroll. You owe 4 years of teaching when you get out. The mentoring is available from senior and mentor teachers who are funded in the schools. Professional development is extensive. Teachers have anywhere from 15 to 20 hours a week for collaboration and professional learning and for meeting one-on-one with kids and teachers. They staff schools with more teachers and fewer non-teaching personnel. Schools are designed to support teacher and student learning. And some of our schools do these things here. But we need to get to a place where the policy system sees this as a goal and makes it not the exception, but the norm. We pride ourselves in the U.S. on innovation, and we still have some of the best schools in the world, some of the most innovative practices. People still come here to see what many of you are doing in innovative schools in the Bay Area. But we don't have ways to scale that up to make that the norm. Innovations come and go. When the leader leaves or the school board changes or the money runs out, you know, the rubber band snaps back to the way that it used to be. So we have popcorn reform rather than sustained continuous reform, which is what you see in places that have grown over the long haul. So these high-achieving nations are aggressively moving from the old factory model approach to education to one in which they're really engaged in a 21st century curriculum in a widespread way. What are those nations not doing? They are not cutting funds to schools and colleges. They're not privatizing education. In fact, in some countries, they have publicized private schools rather than privatizing public schools. They're not ranking and labeling schools and teachers, and they think we're kind of crazy to be doing that here. They're not allocating rewards and sanctions based on test scores, and they're not trying to deprofessionalize teaching. We have some states in the U.S. that also are very high achieving. And if you kind of rank all the states on the national assessment and even against other countries on things like PISA, you will find that Massachusetts, New Jersey, Vermont, Connecticut are up at the top. Sometimes New Hampshire is in that group as well. The three at the bottom in this year, this was a couple of years ago, were California, Mississippi, and Washington, D.C. Well, what are they doing? It turns out to be a very similar list of policies. Massachusetts and Connecticut in the 1990s had reforms that also equalized school funding. Massachusetts had a weighted student funding formula, much like California has just recently introduced, investing in preschool, health care, teacher salaries, standards for preparation, student standards with open-ended assessments, high-quality professional development, school redesign, and steady work over many years. New Jersey is the sleeper case. For 30 years, New Jersey fought school funding reform. Lawyers brought these equalization lawsuits because Princeton and New Brunswick were spending, you know, two and three times as much as Newark and Camden and Patterson and Trenton. And they got nine court decisions saying to the state, you have to equalize. And nine times the state ignored them over 30 years. And finally, in 1998, Christy Todd Whitman, the Republican governor of New Jersey, implemented the court edict to bring parity funding to the, in those cases, they were predominantly African-American districts that were way underspending, and bring them up to the average of the 100 highest districts. They also did preschool in all of those districts. They did a lot of investments in teaching, literacy. Every classroom got classroom libraries, bilingual libraries in the places where that was needed and relevant, lots of training. And within 10 years, New Jersey not only cut the achievement gap in half, and the average black and Hispanic kid in New Jersey was outscoring the average kid in California. They also became one of the highest achieving states in the nation and became first in writing in the top two or three in everything else, with 45% students of color and more than a third of their kids in poverty. All the other high achieving states are much more white and affluent, but New Jersey said you can do this with a population that's very diverse if you do the right thing, if you make the right investments. What that also does is lots more kids graduating, going into the workforce. There was a recent study that found that in states that overhauled school funding and spent 20% more on kids in poverty over a course of their school careers, the graduation rates went up by 20 percentile points. Personal income went up by 25% for those young people. Family income went up by 52%, and the poverty gap was completely closed. And that helps everyone, because all those young people are paying taxes, big taxes if they're earning that much. It's going into the common good. They're not incarcerated. No one's paying for that. And the whole society does better. So California is now beginning to trod that path. And this is great news for this state. We have a new funding plan, the local control funding formula, fondly known to those of us who are in the ed business as LCFF, which goes with LCAP, LCAP. We have so many acronyms. Local control accountability plans. And the new funding plan allocates money equitably with more money for kids who are poor, English learners in foster care. Funding for schools has gone up by 39% over the last 4 years, and we have a good budget, and we're going to see an increase bigger than what was anticipated for next year coming, because the economy is coming back quickly. And by the way, as education gets better and as more kids graduate and fewer go into prisons, that helps our economy in a lot of ways, so it's a virtuous cycle. We have new standards and assessments, Common Core State Standards, Next Generation Science Standards focused on higher order thinking and performance skills. We got rid of two-thirds of the old tests. The CSTs are gone. The new assessments are coming in that are more higher order thinking skills oriented with performance tasks. We have a new accountability strategy, which I will describe quickly, and a new approach to governance. Everything that could be changed about the way California does education business is in the process of being changed. We've also got the elimination of most other mandates, because the governor's philosophy is that if people at the bottom of the system, that is those who are in local communities and schools, know the kids best and know what they need best, we ought to send them money in an equitable way and to the greatest extent possible, let them make decisions. And so local control accountability is about communities coming together with districts to set goals, to be transparent about the use of the new money, to look for ways that to set goals around priorities that are important to that district. There is a set of bumper guards around that, which I'll describe. If schools do not improve and if they struggle, there are ways to address that. And then in the reconceptualization of the assessment system, in a report that the department put out a couple of years ago, it calls for performance assessments of a richer, deeper kind that many schools now engage in, where kids are engaged in project work to a high standard and revising their work and connecting it to the world outside of school, and internships and other things become more the norm, because that's in fact what makes you college and career ready. The investments include all the money I talked about in the LCFF. If you didn't know that acronym before, you can use it as you leave the room and with all your friends. Linked learning, $500 million going into career technical education, much of it preparing kids for college and careers, not college or careers, in these schools that are linked to industries and give them applied ways to learn. Technology investments, transitional kindergarten, professional development, $1 billion a couple of years ago. We'll probably see that much again this year. And an effort to start to recreate professional learning for teachers that is engaging. It's not the drive-by, spray and pray kind of professional development that we've all learned to know and hate. But really, job embedded with coaching from expert teachers, modeling connected to collaborative work in professional learning communities. And you're going to be hearing more about the state's efforts to pull that kind of professional learning together. And we're turning the corner. California's graduation rate for the first time now exceeds 80%, the highest in our history. Just a few years ago, it was 70%. So it has climbed very rapidly in the last few years. Student achievement is going up. Eighth grade students had reading and math gains on the national assessments that were three times greater than the national average. We are now moving into the, not quite to the average, but approaching states that are kind of more in the middle of the distribution. College going rates are turning upward once again. And we have a new concept of accountability. And I just want to say the concept of accountability that has driven the last decade and a half of federal policy and also much California policy was the idea that you test schools, you set targets. If people don't meet the targets, you have sanctions, consequences, punishments. Educators are supposed to be motivated by the fear of those consequences. It's what in the business lingo used to be known as the old theory X, which is that people are only motivated by carrots and sticks, and you have to set up a lot of rewards and consequences. It assumes that people can have the capacity to get the outcomes, know how, and have all the tools at their disposal that they would need, and simply lack the will. And this is supposed to motivate the will. In business theory, the more successful approach is generally known under the guise of theory Y. Deming sort of put these ideas out some years ago. People here wouldn't listen to him. He went to Japan and helped Toyota do it, and the Japanese car market took over our market, and then he came home a hero, and people started to listen to him when Fords weren't selling and Toyotas were. But that's the idea that people mostly want to do the right thing, and they are motivated, we are motivated, by being successful, by learning, by having information about how we're doing and what's working and what's not working, and by the opportunity to work with others to improve around goals. And that's really the new concept of accountability in California. The API is likely to be gone very soon. I was just in Sacramento the last 2 days, and it sounds very much like goodbye to the API. And hello to a multiple measures approach, which is going to be much more informative for improvement, where you can see how are we doing on graduation rates? How are we doing on kids taking A through G? How are we doing on kids taking a career-ready sequence? What about suspensions and expulsions? Are we reducing those? What about school climate? Can we see that our measures of safety and belonging and attachment are getting better for kids and for parents as well as teachers?
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Stanford Professor of Education, Linda Darling Hammond. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The idea of the new assessments is that they'll be used to improve rather than to punish. So from test and punish to assess and improve. There is no link in California, as there is in some other states, between testing on the new assessments and expectations that they will be used to hold kids back, deny diplomas, evaluate teachers, close schools, but that they will be part of an information system that allows people to look at these measures and figure out how to improve. Investment in professional capacity. As the chair of the CTC, we're doing a lot of work to improve the quality of teacher preparation, to move licensure away from the old multiple choice test towards a performance assessment, and then this commitment to resource equity and accountability and an idea of assessment kind of as and for learning. So this new concept, which in fact is what California is doing, it says we want to be accountable for resource equity and the wise use of resources. We want to be accountable for meaningful learning that is engaging and exciting for kids and really prepares them for what they'll do in the future. And we want to be accountable for helping professionals do the best job possible, to be competent and to have growing capacity to do the challenging work that they are being asked to do. A very different idea, and it is spreading across the country. We have 12 states now. I began talking about California's approach in national contexts with chief state school officers and others, wrote a paper on it with a colleague, and 12 states have raised their hand along with California saying, we want to do that. We want to move towards a new approach to accountability. So once again, California may be leading the nation in a good way. And this is what, if you haven't seen it, many of you probably have, are the 8 state priorities in the multiple measures dashboard, from school climate and parent involvement and the provision of basic services and curriculum to a variety of ways of measuring student achievement and outcome and graduation. Districts can adapt that and add to it in the local part of the local control accountability. San Francisco is a part of the core districts, as is Oakland. And in their view of how they want to hold themselves accountable, they've added social-emotional learning and other indicators that they think will help them focus on the needs of their students more effectively. To act differently, we have to think differently. The old approach was kind of that top-down, you know, policy comes from the top. It's based on what I call the fallacy of hierarchical intelligence, that somehow the people at the top always know more than anyone else in the system, and there's one right way to do it. That drove into funding. Much of our funding was in categoricals, which then had to be monitored and tracked. We were hiring lots of people just to keep track of all the money as it was in the 500 categorical programs. Program rules, you know, you've seen the Ed Code. Local boards implement, school sites are supposed to perform. They're not supposed to decide or invent. They're just supposed to implement the rules. And then we manage it all with audits and compliance reviews. The empowerment model starts with community involvement, aims for student achievement. Local boards set policy in collaboration with communities. The state provides the funding. The board empowers the schools. The results are reported to the public. the board that revises policy to continue to improve the outcomes, and we all try to focus on students. And if we are successful, that empowerment model will be what we do. We're talking now about how to create a continuously improving system. The California Collaborative for Excellence in Education is supposed to be the agency that helps us drive continuous improvement. If schools or districts are struggling, they will offer assistance. And if people want to volunteer for their assistance, they could do that too. And the model is to set up learning supports, information systems, ongoing school quality review, something that's already happening in Sacramento and Oakland, innovation and evaluation and knowledge sharing strategies. It's theory, why, in action. The other piece is changing both the goals of the curriculum and the nature of the assessments. And those of you in schools know that the Common Core State Standards and the Next Generation Science Standards are much more focused on higher order thinking skills, communicating, using evidence, and inquiry and research. And we're going to see a big change in the tests. The old CST math item here, some of you will probably recognize it, says John's solution to an equation is shown below, and then asks which property of real numbers did John use for step two. Well, in order to answer that, you just had to memorize which properties were used for what purposes. You didn't even have to be able to solve the problem. So obviously a lot of memorization. Here's a sample task from the new Smarter Balanced where kids get the rules for speeding tickets in Massachusetts, which are allocated according to a formula. In New York, the rules are very flexible. You could get a minimum fine, a maximum fine, and you could get imprisonment depending on how the judge feels. You could get a $90 fine, or you could get charged $300 and be sent to jail for 15 days if you drive 11 miles over the speed limit. Now, if you're a kid learning to drive in high school, you might look at that and say, that looks kind of unfair. And I don't think I want to get caught speeding in New York and get on the wrong side of a judge. But the problem they're asked to solve is, how could you invent a more fair system for assigning speeding tickets in New York? Describe it, model it, provide an equation. So you can see that what we're going to be asking kids to do is a lot different. It's the same thing with English language arts, an old CST item. Here's a task on the Smarter Balanced Assessment, which is one of the performance tasks. You are chief of staff for a congresswoman. You have to address a proposal by a power company to build a nuclear plant in the state to be announced tomorrow morning. The congresswoman says, I don't know anything about nuclear power. Go out and research the pros and cons of nuclear power and give me a memo summarizing the pros and cons. The kids go on a Google website. They find sites. They develop some list of pros and cons. They give them to the congresswoman. They also have to say which sources are the most credible and which ones might be suspected because they are, you know, in one way or another potentially biased. And then the congresswoman says, you know what? I don't really have time to read your memo because I have to give a speech on the floor about this afternoon. Write me a speech and tell me what my position is. And, you know, give evidence on both sides and tell me why I'm making this recommendation, and then the kids do that. So you can see it's a very different kind of goal. But those of you who are in schools where kids are engaged in authentic work, where they themselves own the knowledge and are developing their inquiry skills and using them and working to a standard using that as a mode of performance for graduation, are developing the kind of skills and motivation and commitment to their education and capacity to succeed that we see in the research, where kids who have that experience stay in college at rates much higher and graduate because they're really ready for the demands that they encounter. So, on the docket for the state, returning teaching to its central role as a high-status profession. And that's not going to be done by taking away due process rights from teachers. It's going to be done by ensuring that we have the highest quality preparation for all teachers so that they can come in with much of the knowledge and skills that they want and need to have to teach, by ensuring that we have opportunities for teachers to gain expertise and use it as mentors, as master teachers in collegial, collaborative, job-embedded professional development, by starting some of the kinds of programs like the San Francisco residency program here, which is a training program. And I know that Linda Plack is out here because I heard from her. She's one of the founders of this from the United Teachers of San Francisco. Nice to see you, Linda. Where we put teachers in under the wing of expert teachers in teaching schools and schools that are really learning to be a place that models best practice. They take coursework that's linked to the, what they're doing in the classroom from their university. They get a master's degree. They owe the district some years of service because they got all that for free and with a small AmeriCorps stipend. And then they get 2 years of mentoring and they learn to become a great urban school teacher from other great urban school teachers supported in their entry and then get all of the supports that come along the way. We are at the CTC trying to begin to shave away at eliminating unnecessary paperwork for accreditation and tests. Soon you will be able to skip the CBEST if you had to take it. I know you probably want everyone else to have to do that too, but we're going to make that, optional for most candidates. We're looking at how to take the RECA and fold it into the performance assessment so you can demonstrate that you know how to teach reading in the classroom. And we're looking at ways to support educator leadership so we can identify, recognize, compensate, and share expertise. Some questions for all of us to ask about education reforms in the coming months and years as this unfolds. We should continue to ask whether standards and curriculum as they unfold in all the other subject areas emphasize higher order thinking and performance as opposed to superficial coverage of content. We should ask whether assessments, which I hope will be fewer and deeper, will ask students to apply their learning to genuine problems and communicate their thinking, or merely recall and recognize memorized content, what we call the binge and purge approach to teaching and testing. We should ask about teaching policies, whether they help educators develop and share sophisticated expertise, or whether they foster low skills, high turnover, isolation, and remote control of teaching. We should ask about accountability and improvement policies, whether they foster professional responsibility, and professional in the sense of collegial and in partnership, because that's what professionals do, or competition and gaming among schools and educators. And we should seek to put in place all of the rest of the policies that will allow us to have success in a global world, which is going to continue to tax us in the coming years as we try to transform the system of schools along with the curriculum and the accountability system. And at the end of the day, we should collectively insist that California will make quality education a civil right. And on this week of honoring Martin Luther King Jr., I want to leave you with these words of his, because as if you are in this system or an advocate for the system and for the kids, you encounter times where you have to be very courageous in confronting the results of the system we've inherited. And he said, on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And I thank all of you for all that you do to make education right for all of the children in our schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. So questions, just put up your hand and we'll come to you. I see one right here in the second row.
If I understand you, you were saying that in right around the time that Jerry Brown came into office is when things really started to change. And so I'm wondering, in a couple of years when he's no longer in office, or if he's no longer in office and we have a new administration, what's the possibility that this is all going to revert back, given that we still do have Proposition 13 very much alive and well in California? Two-part question. The other part is I'm wondering, you were explaining how New Jersey had laws that made equal pay for teachers across the state, regardless of where the teachers were, and I know that very much does not exist in California right now. What would it take to have a law like that in California to make pay equal across the state?
We need a revenue solution. Prop 30 has helped. It's brought new money into the state. That money is growing, but the governor has said that he's not necessarily going to extend Prop 30 without the voters, demonstrating that they're ready for a long-term revenue solution. And we need to have everyone speaking out to legislators and to the governor and everyone else that we need a long-term revenue solution. Now, some people say the only way to do it is to get rid of Prop 13. That is a way. There are other ways to, raise revenue and to distribute revenue equitably. One of the things that is a remarkable achievement is this local control funding formula, which now takes all the money and distributes it out based on pupil needs. That's an extraordinary thing to have had happen, not on the heels of an immediate lawsuit. We did have the Williams lawsuit previously. And that will be in place. So now the part of the question is, how do you get the revenues, addressed for the long haul? When Arnold Schwarzenegger came in, I don't know if you remember, but he canceled a bunch of taxes that the legislature had already approved and the people had already approved. Had he not done that, we wouldn't have had much of the slide in that decade. I think people now realize for a long time after Prop 13, like the first decade, the slide was gradual and people kind of didn't realize what it was doing to the state. By the time it finally got addressed, people realized what it was doing to the state. So I think we're going to have to look to our leaders to create that long-term revenue solution. And I hope and I believe that Brown will step up to that before he leaves office, because he has the leadership imprimatur at this point, to do that tough job. Now, the question about salaries. We are a local control state, and more so now than we were even 4 or 5 years ago with the way that the policies are being shaped. So how do you deal with salaries in that context? Connecticut many years ago had a very innovative approach, and we did a version of this a few years ago in California, a few years like in the late 90s, I think. And that was that they created an incentive. They created a minimum state salary, a minimum salary level, and they incentivized districts to raise their salaries to at least that minimum. And if you were a poor district, you got a bigger allocation from the state to do that than if you were a rich district. So it was equalizing in its effect. And that's how they closed the gap. I think there's also a hope that as districts become more equitably funded, Oakland was way underfunded, but now it's going to have a lot of money as LCFF, comes online. How do you change the attitude of a district that has been devaluing teachers for decades so that it understands the value of investing in teachers is part of the local question as well. But there are state strategies that could be tried. There are also going to be, a need for real local activism around now districts that have the resources, spending them in ways that will make it possible for them to attract and keep a high-quality educator workforce.
Thanks so much to all of you for coming out tonight. Most of all, thank you, Linda Darling-Hammond.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Stanford Professor of Education Linda Darling-Hammond. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature host of NPR's Weekend Edition, Scott Simon. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.